Good morning and welcome. My name is Susan Turnbull. On behalf of the GSA Office of Intergovernmental Solutions, the Emerging Technology Subcommittee of the CIO Council, and the National Coordination Office for Networking and Information Technology Research and Development, we would like to welcome you to this guest lecture. I'm going to turn now to Simone Zickman, who is the Director of the National Coordination Office for NetID.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't have any particular remarks, but I did want to just take a moment to introduce our esteemed speaker today. I'm very pleased to be introducing Dr. Douglas Engelbart, whose insights and achievements over a long period of time I'm sure many people are familiar with, and the work that he's done over his career has helped advance the frontiers of computing for many years. This is an area where we're continuing to be called upon to develop new advances to help people and society work together more effectively. And advancing this vision is something that Doug continues to do in his career. His teams have made a variety of advances on the technical side, including things like hypertext networked computing, Windows, and some of the precursors to graphical user interfaces, as well as some of the social innovations that are related to computing, including groupware, distributed work, human-computer coevolution models, and so on. And the advances that have been made in the past continue to see new innovations for the future. He's also been highly recognized for his achievements over his career. Doug has authored over 25 publications, generated over 20 patents, including the patents for the mouse, which many people are aware of. He's recipient of many awards, including the 1997 Lumelson MIT Prize, which is the world's largest single prize for technical innovation and invention. He's also recipient of the 2000 National Medal of Technology, the highest award for technical achievement in the United States. Doug is here to share his insights with us today in the areas of with his talk, which is entitled Facilitating the Evolution of Our Collective IQ, Strategically Improving Our Capability for Coping with Complex, Urgent, and Large-Scale Problems. And with that, I'm very pleased to introduce Doug. Thank you very much. Can anybody hear me? This is about technology. Testing. We all excused. Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now is that working? Okay. All right. I've got a very soft voice. Okay. Well, this is really a pleasure. I've been a fan of Susan's for a long time. So one time when one of my daughters was working with me and I were here in Washington, I've been pushing around a lot, so I informally adopted her. So I don't get to be here often enough to be sure she behaves. So, so I do like what she's been doing. Stimulating, motivating, helping the community grow, people that someday can become the real Nick. That's the time you get going. Thank you. I've got about 3 hours worth of slides. Well, anyway, what I start out with is this actually is almost word for word what launched me, if you want to believe it, it was 54 years ago. So then I went ahead and got married, my unsuspecting wife, and quit my job and went back to graduate school, and ever since then I've been fully manner of how to do this. And so anyway, one thing I'll mention that I forgot to get into, Jerry Glenn here in the Boston area has this Millennium Project, and this is one I first ran across some years ago that really helped see, okay, people were really thinking about
very large goals, and I'm not going to go into detail here because of not the time, but I just really like to get a boost to this work sometime. Go back here, when I talk about collective IQ, I just say it's a collective capability. And I was really thinking about how we could do something to help the world. I was very idealistic then, almost as much as I am now, in 1951. And realizing finally that these world's really tough, big problems have to be dealt with collectively, and that we're not getting collectively smart as operation group that's going to handle something. How do they get... So, and I'm trying to get some words here, like saying, the collective capability to develop an adequate, comprehensive understanding of the problem situation, the possible solutions, the resources required, resources available, and smart enough to select a good approach, and then handle all of the follow-ups that happen during trying to implement a good approach. Say, how do we get collectively more capable of doing this? And almost any one of you, I think, comes from some domain in which you could pinpoint some big, serious problem. Whether it's a serious professional society trying to get it together better and understand this domain. Anyway, on here like this, it's very clear after a few years of maybe thinking about this that we're talking about capability, and we have to think of it in a general sense. So emerged for me this capability infrastructure picture, and it's saying that any major capability that you feel you have or some organization must have, both cases, is comprised of the infrastructure. Because there are many other subordinate capabilities that have to be combined in order to get this major capability. And it's really a big one. And how far down does it go? Well, let's make a further picture about this. This began with this capability infrastructure, and then open the door, some techie guy comes in and he says, oh, I got artifacts, and he starts telling me about computer technology, and then you start thinking, oh, hey, these artifacts have been showing up in our world for a long, 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 long time. And is there something new about things you're talking about? Oh, absolutely, it's going to solve everything. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, let's see. What happened to the other things when they came in? Oh, we realized that there was some parallel system that was evolving concurrently with that. Had all these other factors in it. Here it is, too. We've got all of this depends fundamentally on basic human capabilities. Sensory, perceptual, cognitive, motor. Back to this in a while. But we take for granted what's there. He says, well, we have to take basic human, develop the skills, the knowledge, the training, the cultural conditioning, etc., so that they can fit within that human system. And so they have the skills to operate the tools. That's a whole big system where I come to calling that an augmentation system. And that model has just done me a great deal of misalignment or proper alignment or whatever, but it's just terribly important to my mind, especially as we begin to talk a little bit later here about the scale of the issues that are really out there to go after. And you look at all of this and you say, boy. And then there's something else there. Technology. So there's an interface here. It's actually been there since the beginning. Since the beginning of any kind of social development. Or something like that. Okay, that's the interface between the basic human and this whole augmentation system. And, the human-computer interface has been having a lot of study and emphasis on it. It's only part of it. And then it seemed to have gotten, in my mind, hobbled greatly at the early stage by saying, I've been teaching to learn. As though the computer coming in was just going to automate some small thing for you, like a microwave oven in your house. Instead of being just an absolutely disturbing interface between you and all of the kind of knowledge and development of information activity in the world. So I said, well, there's a little factor down here that slowly through the years got to have more and more and more significance to me than perception. I talk about it. And my crude understanding is you're assailed with sensory stimuli, and central machinery is what takes that, turns it into whatever usable you have. And that has a lot of development through the years for you. If you just scan the room, hey, you know, if you were just first became aware of visual stimuli, it'd just be open chaos of what you were seeing. Oh, but your sensory stuff, your perceptual stuff, just, oh, you know, people say, just almost instantly understand what it is. And when writing alphabet came out, and people said, well, these little symbols represent vowels and consonants, and you put a string of them together, and it's sort of like what that word will be, but pretty soon you can really recognize that, yes, it's representing that word, and you don't have to go, when you do it, you boom, it flips into your mind. And pretty soon as you sweep across the page, lines, you know, it's just the flow of concepts related there into your mind. But that's been developing a long time. The machinery that's back there doing that hasn't changed appreciably, apparently, since the alphabet appeared. And yet they say, okay, and here comes the computer. What do people do with it? They say, oh, we're going to automate what you do when you're writing, reading a page. And for some strange reason, this guy in the 60s, when he finally could get support for looking at this and saying, hey, wait a minute, the computer is something that can provide you much different portrayals. And at your bidding, well, why don't we start looking at different ways to portray things to ourselves? This perceptual machinery could adapt to, as it has to all this other, and we get many books. So out of that comes this quiet, peaceful, non-antagonistic statement of mine is saying, well, books are going to become out of date, obsolete. And, oh boy, all the garbage has been thrown in. There's something about what people thought. I say, well, you know, the technology can give you any sort of physical feel you want about the screen for. And it can give you other sort of sensory stimuli too if you want to learn how to get your perceptual machinery connected to it. And so, hey, let's go after that. And it can give you mobility of moving around. Oh yeah, we can scroll. Hey, I mean mobility. I mean you can jump. Boop, boop, boop. Oh yeah, well, we can have links. I know, but you ought to have addressability to any object and any document. So click on a link, bingo, you're there. You don't have to go to the document and scroll to find out what the hell it meant. And like that. So it was with this sort of orientation that we started in the mid-60s. So our system that we called NLS is just very different. You realize, oh, there are a lot of functionality you want to have in there too. And people think, yeah, you'd like to use verbs and nouns and things about that. Our language can look like that. If we get to it, I'll just show you some examples of that. And very quick ways of specifying what verb or what noun, just the minimal number of characters to type in. And this vocabulary is just good. And when people first come to work in the environment, you have the tech support, get them so they're booted up, but when they offer them a very limited vocabulary, somebody, a secretary that had never even heard of a computer, come to work, and within an hour, they start really comfortable doing the word processing for it. Then you move on to the spreadsheet. Anyway, so this is the kind of thing that's been passed up. And so what this introduces is another interesting topic called paradigms. I just accidentally this is the head of the list over here in human systems. And was this a really, really, really important thing about paradigms. And I said a story ahead too, a funny story about the humanity's vehicle. All of us had our different social groups and little compartments in this great big vehicle that actually is moving through the future into future. Very rough ground is moving, and it's can't see very far ahead. And if it did see very far ahead, its steering is very, very, very clumsy. And you say, oh, we're getting propelled faster and faster. And the blame for this can go on as much as possible to the technology, which has made it this way. So if we don't improve our visibility and our ability to steer this vehicle, my conclusion is it's just clearly doomed. That we can't keep rushing off into things that we're making one more and more complicated, not really learn how better to see what's being, what's ahead, what's steer. So to me, this is just... I'm a very quiet guy. The best I can do is say, hey, hey. I feel it's really important. So, like, how do we get the world to pay attention to things? You know, even if it weren't catastrophically important for us to do this, to avoid catastrophe, it'd be very, very important for really learning how better, how any agency or government can understand better and cope. How any scientific community can understand better and cope. The world can change, how the education system can evolve and change. So let's get on and talk about some of these things. So my contention is that this model here is scalable. It works already scaled. And saying, all right, so if we are really going to boost that augmentation, well, where would you stop? Well, did you practice? Well, yeah, sure. Well, how about the whole country? Well, not that it needs it, but, well, yes, let's try it with that. Well, any one country? Well, we better do it as a whole. How do we get that started? Anyway, so this scale is really an extremely important thing. And one of the very first things I managed to get support for, to tell you about paradigm, when I started out with computers, there were about four in the country. Big cash, magnitude machines. And for me to be talking about someday we'll be using them interactively, that's equivalent to saying, someday, each one of us will own his own helicopter. So it was really laughable. Paradigms just, I get back off the stage. Universities, I got my PhD at Berkeley and was told after a while, you keep talking like this, you'll be an acting assistant professor forever. So here's how peer review works. So, I get it. So I went down the peninsula, and this would help if I put in a pitch at Stanford to say, I can teach computer courses, you know, design courses and such. Oh, the dean of engineering came back and says, well, since computers are only a service activity, we don't contemplate ever having design courses. And then Bill Packard was the major electronic outfit down there, so... Well, they like the patents I got from my PhD research and such, and all that hope would be required. It was in one way out. I thought, so, well, oh, by the way, to the head of research, I'm assuming you guys are going to get to computers, because I'm committed for my career. Oh, sorry, Doug, not a chance. Paradigms, see? So, how fast do paradigms change? What I'd really like to see is somebody in social science be astrophysics or whatever else it takes, kind of understanding what are the dynamics for generalized paradigms, say just within the professional community or between larger communities, but then to shift and say, we're looking ahead, what are the things you could practically consider doing? Paradigm. No, that's not a workable thing. So anyway, the scale kind of thing, the paradigms are just critical. I keep talking about that. So that's what I meant. It wasn't until 1957 I went to work at the Central Research Institute, the now SRI, progressive as any research group could build. It took me 6 years before I could really get a chance. And here came DARPA's office, Information Processing Techniques office opened up. And well, they were trying to get things going, so they started giving me money. And you know, but I found out some years later that it was a bit tired of the guy who started giving me money. He really got banged by his MIT friends for putting contract money way out there. Aren't any computer programmers of any distinction to work. And National Institutes of Health gave me a proposal the time in there too, and they said, we like what you're thinking of doing, but since you're way out there, we're not. So I'm not so sure that anyway, paradigms. Anyway, the strategic approach is, so what does the term strategy bring in mind? I won't go into that, but I get very, very different perceptions from people. Many times they say the strategy for doing this or that is basically a tactical thing. This is what I would do next. And okay, well, strategy is encompasses you're doing that because what you want to do on that and how you're better. I found that I was working on strategic things here because of the scale, and very, very hard to communicate that too. And it's a matter of paradigm. So now that the world and the people have progressed so far, I think I can stand here and say that without getting peppered with anything more than raw tomatoes. So anyway, some paradigms shifting. So anyway, this primary strategy came out as collective IQ. So the model I made is have a group, all kind of people, and you assume that they're all talking to each other and that they're interacting with the external environment in which the situation is, that they're trying to learn the best and understand the best. So they have to scan, ingest it, interact, they have to have dialogue, they like to record the dialogue, how to just do a rock, it follows its correction, and out of all that, build a knowledge product. They're dynamically, concurrently integrating, collaborating, developing, learning, using. I rearranged the terms for collectively developing, integrating, and applying knowledge. I could give it an acronym. I heard someplace back there it's very important to have acronyms, so what's your acronym? Well, this is the capability what we try to go after. That. So you say, well, what scale are we talking about there? Well, this is, anyway, I came to call this knowledge collection a dynamic knowledge repository, because that's highly dynamic, up to date, not only learnable from, up to date, and I'll talk more about it later.
No, no, for the best.
Plus DKR, and the ability to actually build, keep them up to date, and learn from them, etc., and argue around them, all of that is a very, very basic thing in my mind. Teaching. Anyway, and currently they say, okay, here's the collection of government agencies we have around here, and they're all being doing pretty well. Says, oh, well, that's great. That would be good to see. And then we said, well, that's got to be scaling up. Oh, well, we'll get all of the other government agencies in the states and the cities and the counties, etc. And they need to. What's the relationship between your DKR and that DKR? Well, it has to be very self-consistent, the interaction point. And that concurrency thing scales up, and you realize that it's not much good for you just to fix one agency. Unless you're fixing, trying to get a bunch of them together. That's what started, but what it needs is more energy, more resources of various kinds. Okay, large-scale facilitated evolution. No one can specify the design of our future capability infrastructure. There's too many concurrent things that are evolving concurrently with it. And it's okay, somebody come up with, do you see the thing that the guy comes from Kentucky coming, I've got a fix for you. Oh, well, that's kind of cute. You know, I thought, I'll pick up something like that. And he said, well, I've got to fix the rest of it. Oh, never mind. That's the important one. And then you have to set up something in which the evolution concurrently takes place and freed up. And you've got to start evaluating the innovations that have been offered in the sense of where is all that evolution going? Well, how do you do that best? Well, it would be just great as if when we learn how to build DKRs, one of the first ones we build is what's the structure like? How do we get better and better capability? So that what I call facilitating that evolution is giving every organization via that DKR best possible view of what the frontier is like. That organization can make up its own mind on its particular things, which way it's going to move as it's starting keeping on improving its capabilities. So that evolutionary process, how can we facilitate it? So that's the whole thing. So we say, I was very bold one day. I said, suppose I look at the different multidimensional artifact tool system thing and one dimension, and the same thing with the human system. This is kind of what I would say. What would it be like to group societies of today on here? And so we appreciate that they're primitive ones, but none of them had it without any kind of artifacts of that. Right on up, and up here becomes your agency, of course. Okay, and how they've been evolving? Well, all through the kind of history we have, some of the people in there would be aware that there are things, changes coming, and we better, if we want to stay ahead, kind of be alert to them. But it wasn't very dynamic. But hey, how about that interacting system? Well, there's a mind-boggling rate and scale of technology change that's generating accelerating rate of opportunities. Oh, I see. And our paradigm is already lagging well behind the opportunities. Paradigm change has to be accelerated too. Human skills, culture, governance are already severely stressed with paradigm change. We need a setup that can effectively facilitate the human tool system co-evolution of our collective augmentation systems. This is just a critical thing. Question?
Yeah. I'm not clear what you mean by paradigm. Can you just explain it again, please?
As you're a sociologist? Well, here's my... I'm an engineer that's got an educated picture like that. It's sort of, what is it that somebody poses something to you as an option for doing something? Oh, bullshit. I mean, but anyway, you know, how do you do it? And then what framework is it? Where does that come from?
Iraq can be solved by guns is a paradigm.
Right. It's basically the worldview you're looking at.
It's the view, but it even can be very local. It's about, well, what's a practical thing to do in your household in case of some situations. What's reasonable? I'm sorry, that's not a practical thing to do. It don't happen. It affects any kind of political decision in the voting pools very, very much. And, I won't go into that.
As a sociologist, Thomas McCoon has been studying on the scientific revolution. Sorry. There is a classic study by Thomas Coombs on the scientific structure of change, where he does discuss paradigms in terms of changes in society.
Thank you. I stumbled on that book.
But if I could, Coombs' basic point was that paradigms can always explain everything right up until the point where the world fails.
Yeah.
All right? And so the bottom line here is 9/11 wasn't enough. We need an order of magnitude 9/11 to actually change our paradigm.
It is really, really important. And, you know, for a part of the governance of any group, particularly, you know, looking at you guys, United States, this is something really, really, really serious about. Talking about the governance of the United States, a big part of that is the steering of it. And so, what's the tyranny like, really? How do we best steer? And it's a serious, serious question about this. They haven't been ready at all for the rapid emergence of the technologies. One thing. But not only in the problems it causes, but in the potential. That's the potential side is the one that I really feel is critical to get going, because my personal view that this kind of collective IQ is something that really, really can be elevated. And I'm sorry to say to all the book lovers, I don't think it's going to get the kind of elevation it needs until we supersede reading the way you read, etc. I should, you know, because one of the researching things I really want to do is check on this perception. People are not reading. They don't know. They don't even have to know parts of speech or something. But okay, I just say, I wonder what would happen if you had automatic parsing, which they have very effective ones done. In your electronic reading, you had a choice to read which the different parts of speech were different color or brightness or size or something, or even blue dictionary. And your sensory perceptual machinery, sensory would use it. It's perceptual, but very soon, if you just start reading, I'm feeling the gut a lot. I'm like one half, one third of my net worth. All 4,000 hours. I've been willing to bet that pretty soon that machinery would start to get it. And even though you yourself didn't understand formalities of syntax, start to get it. And if you were in a hurry, how you'd scan, which ones you'd be looking for. And also to tell the computer, just show me the things, the main stem of the sentence. That's what's going to lead me to where I want to go. This kind of optimal viewing, which is true. Anyway, if you're reading a book at late in the evening and it's hard to see, you can't crank up the font size, can you? And if you think you've done enough studying on your homework, you can't just, you have to go hunting for the novel, don't you, instead of, I know it's a natural way to read and what you're born by, but something kind of nice about a computer and the size and shape. And also, I'm just sure the technology can do things like fix it so your glasses or your contact lenses can be fixed so that if you want to, that's the whole thing you see is your computer screen. You can make it be like this, so the rest of it you can see around here. Oh, you can see maybe like a telescope from distance, in fact. Only the best, that's what can show up soon. And there's extremely a lot of things in our paradigms just looking up here and further exciting. And then what is out there with all the changes that can be, as well as energy wise, we're running out of. And we didn't worry about the warming for Taylor. This kind of stuff like this, it'd be just like you're in a room with somebody. Why do you have to compete? That's there to go after. So, who's doing it? Well, anyway, the thing about this frontier out there is much greater because of the acceleration in technology. And with all the new things that's bringing, you know that that's opening up a lot of new things in the human system. So that's a wide open frontier. So, hey, that's the most sudden sort of emergence of the
White House calling.
That's the response I was waiting for. So anyway, you look in there and you says, okay, here's the real thing about, whoever feels slightly responsible for preparing ourselves for the future, there's that. And what's the best root changes you want to make? Gosh, who knows? Is anybody building out those houses or trying something new and different? Well, these are a lot farther out than we probably could be able to get something like this. But anyway, this is the kind of thing. So, hey, we need your DKRs really to get going, to try to give us the best possible understanding of the paths, the changes, etc., that we can make in our large social groups, etc., capabilities of the practices, etc. And it's like some of those paths are just not going to be adequate, or some will tie us up. So nobody can say just exactly where best to be at all. So the best we can do is to get better and better about building a map. The map would come from...
Going back to what you're saying right here and this earlier comment, going back to the earlier question about what paradigm and comments right here, one of the things we're using in the work we're doing is a paradigm is essentially...
My name is Roy Roebuck, and I'm working on a project called Continuity of Communications Enterprise Architecture for the Federal Executive Branch. And I'm the chief architect for the effort. And one of the things we're doing is we're stating that a paradigm is essentially a recognition of a possible path forward. The recognition is the key part, because the path may have always been there, but you may not have seen it until it just hits you in the face because of some crisis, some emergency, something like this. New Orleans, things like this right now. There are possible paths forward that you're talking about here that are cumulative, like your Kodiak, for example. I see your Kodiak is essentially being a cumulative and spiraling outward capability. Do you have any examples of where that's perhaps taking place? Who's doing something like that? Because I'd like to collaborate on that with them.
The UN Millennium Project.
No, that's just the kind of thing I'm imploring. We've got to get started. And so I have back here some kind of a schema for strategically going after that.
Yeah. Right. And I'll just mention, there's going to be plenty of time to talk with Doug after the formal talk, and so we hope that others with ideas will stay and join in that conversation.
Well, at this rate, I won't be through till 2:30. You as an audience are stimulating me too much. It's your fault. Okay, let's move on. So, this is sort of an abstract approach to saying, well, what kind of help? So, I just took any kind of organization that's trying to exercise the capability to help or do something or produce something for whatever you want to call as a customer. So, this is okay. And that organization is doing its A work. It's just its basic way it does its stuff. All right? If it's kind of wanting to be improving, then it has a B budget, B activity, that is trying actually to improve the capability of the A activity. And then, if it becomes really smart, it's looking around the outside world to try to learn how better to do the B work. Or how to see. And so you say, well, if you're in any kind of work, engineering or pharmaceutical or something, your C and budget is what kind of pays for time and effort for your key guys to go out and participate in professional societies. It's like, well, right, that's the way to do it. Common interest identified out as a group. So he said, there are lots that are existing that we'd be interested in right now. And it's a new one that can form, because this would be a special way to do it. And we say, well, one of the things we want is to say, hey, you're working as a
called up the Pruitt Committee, why don't we actually take a step and say, if you guys really adopt the latest of how this DKR collective IQ stuff works in the network, let's just label you a network improvement committee. And say, hey, that's one place for getting better at this collective IQ to make an explicit approach improvement. Well, as it turns out, strategically, it's also a pathway to it just kind of handled the scale we're trying to talk about of how you deal with these NICs, get them going. And so anyway, and actually employing a NIC DKR. But anyway, where are we going to get better at building these DKRs? Well, this book appears as a really crappy way to talk about it, that we're improving the community. And its central activity is fostering its own DKR. It says, okay, how about building, organizing a NIC? The members are NICs, and their combined collective purposely pursuit is how do you get better and better at being a NIC? So this looked to me like this is a pathway we could really do in the social structures and scale we're talking about as a chance for everybody working. And anyway, this is a kind of common goal of continuously improve our large-scale improvement capabilities. Network improvement community seems to be a big chance. Prime goal, improve the collective IQ of the NICs. Organize NICs into a large-scale, ever-improving improvement infrastructure for facilitating the concurrent evolution of associated augmentation systems. But this to me is sort of a central focus. And then there are a lot of interesting practical questions about how you do that. There are practical questions about the candidates for really helping improve your dynamic knowledge repository capabilities or collective IQ. And so, the side of my work that's focused on technologies has all been oriented about that. Testing, collaborating, and there are lots of different technologies that you can bring in. And especially if you start thinking about, hey, the book is not the model. We can build our own new model of what we can provide for us. And the capabilities that humans can exercise, skills, etc., aren't going to be limited by what you have to say is, it's got to be easy to learn. Which came in when people thought this was just something to automate. And, so open that up. So our system that I had in the next hour, I can show you samples and things of how that would get. But I think I'm running out of time.
Ten more
minutes, and then questions. Fine. Well, here's one sort of element of strategy, and out of this came the term bootstrap that I've been using for decades. So here's a NIC all set up to improve our collective IQ. So you say, okay, great. What's one and two mean? Well, one is what currently available information about collective IQ. That's what you have collected from our surroundings. And two is, hey, the best we can do is to knowledge about improving that. So, hey, here's a logical thing. We should just set that up like this. So as fast as we make any significant headway, we adopt it ourselves inside of that NIC. The better we get at getting better, the better and faster we get better. Well, that's like, the old fable about lifting yourself up by a bootstrap. Well, that's sort of compound interest. So that's the whole scheme that we're setting up, trying to do. So then if you say, I had a meta NIC, make a mix, that could be a really, really important thing. What do you do about that? and say, great, I got that feedback loop going. Every other NIC in the world could benefit directly and as fast as possible by being able to improve its collective IQ capability. Okay, that's a kind of bootstrapping thing. So, conceptually, that's scalable. So, you know, each country could have its central NIC to, you know, designing and improving things that are suitable for its language and culture. To know it has to interact with the other world, so, okay, so we actually combine a worldwide one that says, how do we keep maximizing the way we can concurrently develop and understand knowledge ahead between us? Just like sort of a universal language, except it's got to be. When you think about building this, so Google can help you find all kinds of things. Well, that's pretty neat. But that's just a start. How do you put it together and integrate it? Like, suppose somebody has a mail group system and are talking about some interesting. Oh, great. You know, now we've got 723 mail items out there. Oh, that's great. Boy, now we're reading. And suddenly now we really got it. I know, but what does it add up to me? Oh, well, you can go read it. Oh, so what we're talking about, the integration stuff, is how do you go to integrate it? Put the pieces together until you've got some smoothly comprehensible thing. And yes, there's still pros and cons, and arguments still exist for those who clearly stand out. Who disagreed upon yet. They're based upon these kind of arguments. But they're actually these nice, practical, structural ways to show that kind of issue-based argument. And this is great. And the linkage could be such. So here's where the kind of high-resolution addressing and linking that we built, and I'm going to tell you about it a minute more, is there, that you point right to a passage. It's for this guy, the guy who's claimed. He claims it will work, he claims it will. And then one of the supportive arguments. Oh, finally, sort of like your high performance accountants would go through and say, overhead for sure. You got some high capability. Like a guy that can go through about this argument structure. Come on, say, look, structural argument. This one. As long as you feel that this strong thing located here is relatively essentially right, then bingo, this is the conclusion of that issue. And if you have arguments to make, here's where you put it. Well, anyway, so one of the things that we need is this kind of a documentation system that we need, because the open is going to have a lot of extended capabilities in order to be the tool system to do this thing. And so anyway, and what does the term hyper mean? Well, as far as I know, we were the very first ones to build systems with links, etc. And we started out saying we want to be able to address every object. And then we started out saying we want to have different views. Well, what do you mean? Well, in one case, programmers fix it so that if I do something simple, the view will change to show me just the first line of every paragraph. Oh, why do you want to do that? Well, just wait. Oh, it'd be surprising how valuable that became, shifting back and forth between that. Did you see one line only? Is it that's where I want to go? No, this is that quick. And then we got other views, like then we organized things hierarchically. And so you could say, how many levels deep do I want to look? Same thing, or I only want to look in this one branch, or I only want to see those paragraphs that have certain content. So, and our addressability got so refined like that too. Oh, we'll just start using that for your commands. So I don't have to go point and click or grunt, I call the pigeon English of interfaces. You have ready verbs and nouns that you really use. And so your addressability is such that you pretty soon can use one of them. I want to copy the second paragraph I had in this window. The file was in this window before this one. Oh, okay, so we have an address, .fr 2. And that would photograph that second paragraph without you looking at it and copy it here if you want. Or you could even interchange 2 if you didn't even see. In spreadsheets, you could say, I want to transpose or move columns, just that. I want to move a column, transpose it to column, change rows. That's our engineering. We had spreadsheets in the 70s, too, before they got to be popular. Anyway, in the documents, the sense that that's our packages system. Ollie's workshop is what I started using the term, which is a very meaningful thing. If you go into any workshop, there are all the tools. Oh, yeah, but then what kind of materials can they deal with? Oh, well, you need to know, yeah, that's part of it. Yeah. But what's the vocabulary, the processes that you use on it? Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. All right.
Just
determined. No. Are people on the line still with us?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Yes.
And Peter, that was your fault. No, I really want to say that this was in the activity group. I'm just very, very impressed with how Peter M. has been supporting and the way in which it can evolve along with. You couldn't go get any commercial support service like that. And it wants to migrate on into really evolving into ever better techniques. You have to have a support like that. It really has to be evolved. He's put on a lot to do that. Anyway. So, anyway, how to get started in this debate? You have to think about capabilities as being the very first kind of thing. So, a lot of fun things I could be showing are typical examples of tuning and moving and the command structure. But just to be sure I don't miss the kind of key thing that I'm going to do, I'm going to jump. Anyway, so.
We're on slide 49.
Correct. All right, so we have to co-evolve all the data. We have to provide a direct, useful entry step for the first stage of all that coordination. So that's what I call the OHS development. So candidate legacy thing for this is, hey, all these different kinds of archives, let's say, what's the legacy types for that? I hear all kinds of stuff about it. Okay. Oh, sorry, folks. Target legacy server software. And what we set up is an intermediate server. And what we're going to do then is that support browser. The idea then, the browser is having, when it sees a particular kind of link with URL at these strange syntax, it will send it to this intermediate. And it will go get the file. We'll get the file. File gets shipped off HTTP, and there'll be a transformer for it that transforms it into an intermediate standard file that have an interesting added set of metadata, which are just inferentially developed with algorithms from the target file. But among those things will be tags that will let you address any object. So that's what it has. So that the console says, okay, I got that object. Oh, the server says, well, the link then, oh, And now I want to go to that place, I want to see this view.
Oh,
this hands this view generator. And then it sends it off to the browser. Here's the view starting at the point you asked for. So he says, okay, that would start letting the world things out there in the HTML world that we've been doing for a long time in this augments this, you know, and it really makes a difference in that. So what's then added is, okay, you can say, okay, how do I move around with it? So you start getting some kind of interaction in your browser about how you move, jumping, as well as scrolling. But how do I specify different views? Oh, you can start simple and expand however you want. But then here's an interesting thing. It says, oh, so that was an HTML file. Oh, I'd like to see some Word files. Oh, great, let's make a transformer for a Word file. Oh, let's make one for spreadsheet, for PDF, or, computer component design environment, database. Okay, every one of those places becomes something you can think and jump around inside and do. And he says, wow, that makes a slight difference. Well, I started laying this out 2 years ago, and I think I'm going to get a little bit of money. And it's but it's just been very hard to explain, to get people to hear and listen. It's okay, this will really start a path. So, well, for one thing, another thing to add is from this link database sitting down here, is this intermediary server can keep track of links coming from where, pointing to where. And I got the whole link here. Keep track of it. Oh, so one set of views you can have looking through a document is to say, I'd like to be aware of from just my community or links of a certain type. So you say, oh, it would be very handy to start having a field and agree upon a set of types. It's like, which is a really important thing if you want to start getting structured logic stuff. Hey, even if it's plus I agree or negative, I disagree. There are more refinements that I think can be. So that big database would just enrich in your working environment hugely. So why isn't it out there? Well, it's been a while. It's funny, we put that on, published on the web 5 or 6 years ago. Are you hearing? I think that to be the thing I feel is a starting point. It can open up a brand new set of kind of capabilities and open up a lot of things that will naturally be sort of adapted by people to do things. And those that want to start learning about this structured argument things, it's very, very cool. And it's that sort of thing that would help that integration. For instance, in our augment environment from way back, 1970, when we first started doing email. Every paragraph in every email item is a guest line. So you never get an email that's answering somebody else's email. Here's a 2-sentence answer and a 15-sentence thing it's responding to, and then what that's responding to. It just makes us shudder at the fact that you could just say, hey, what you said in bingo, I disagree because, hey, look what John said over here. Oh, well, it just cleans up efficiency of it. Just terrible. So, I got more stuff. I can just show us that sort of some of the views, many options you can do, like the people like to argue and discuss.
Yes, sir. Yes, I think there'll be questions. And honestly, we're kind of past, we're not in the, you know, any rush. So just for people that would like, you know, like to continue with the conversation, pass.
Just a simple question. You mentioned Peter's work with SIM3. All the purple numbers and things like that, actually an implementation of this capability, those kind of communities working with those tools. Like, I'm sorry, in the wiki type environment is where you have the linking and the hyper-extension type of thing.
In our NLS augment system beginning in the 60s, we gave every paragraph a location number. You know, and since it was hierarchical, it could be like 3D5. It would tell you the third chapter, the second section of the map. Like that. And so, one of the use specs is you can have those numbers turned on to show or not turned on. And there's more sophisticated things like that available too. And so when we started putting things out on the web 10, 12 years ago, they wanted to put those numbers out there in the lower right-hand corner and make them addressable. Pound sign after the rest of the URL, pound sign 3B, that one. And somebody, a friend of ours, why don't you make it so that if you, that they're an active link to itself, you could go over and right-click and pick up the name of that link and come in place, and that would be a link bringing back to that version. Or you just go and click on it and jump to it. Well, so those became then other people that started interacting with us. Gene Kim and Peter Yim started taking that up and made them work up what they call the purple numbers, and that's been picked up other places too. Then they got the blogs, Peter got the blogs and the wikis. That purple number is on them to helps facilitate money to things. And there's still a lot we'd like to see added to that.
Early in your talk you referred to
I'd like to return to the construct of your paradigm with Nick. Are there any mathematical or systems models?
Boy, I don't know. I would really welcome discussion about that. And, I'm talking about discussion of dialogue. I mean, it seems to me it's like that. What do you mean? Yeah. But just getting back to paradigms or something is that some strange way I stopped publishing 13 years ago. And I finally realized unconsciously I just came up that nobody ever responds to any of them. But I really would like to have dialogue that can kind of accumulate and go. And so I would like for you to tell me more.
Erstwhile physicist, you know, if I can't put it down on paper and understand the interaction, that's hard time. I mean, the construct is very interesting, but the whole notion, for example, you saw a paradigm, you use it as a transition. This is generally the same step, the phase transition, sometimes it may be, and then what's the structure?
Well, Einstein, I understand, really changed the paradigm.
Or citation analysis. If you can do citation analysis at the paragraph level,
right.
You have just blown open.
No, exactly. I understand, but you know, I think this is worth a lot more discussion.
Yes,
I think this is very important.
Well, thank you.
I have a research for you
right
on that lab. I can tell you a little bit more later. I have to get the citation.
Thank you. Earlier in your discussion, you referred to what is actually wearable computing, the eyeglasses. Explain further how this area of wearable computing fits into automation and paradigm shifts, collective intelligence.
Well, it's some of the advances of the technology extend the possibilities of your augmentation. So how do you evolve the integration of that? I think you could imagine that if the glasses could fix themselves, what you saw was as real. You were off by yourself.
And what you see transformed into a new kind of business model where the inputs result in new products without really any asset financial investment, but you're generating new products that are economically value added.
There's another whole thing about the generation of the products and the prevailing practices in the business world of tying things down like patents, et cetera, which are necessary for them, but in some places really block evolution. So those are all sociocultural things that we have to adapt to. But sure, I think technology can innovate these things. The bomb come out, be products. All of that. But software is where I feel that open source evolution is just really critical because I tie it to the natural language. Talking about moving, looking, doing, that and all like this. That has to be the way you talk. And I think, well, if people that were building machine shops, they can offer the names for things that are like this, which is a trundle or this and that. They get adapted to something, but they have to be something that your natural language can integrate into this discussion. And so, this is the way. It just can't be that, oops, that verb I patented. There's just no way you can evolve that way. So, that's why I'm saying open hyperdocument system. The hyperdocument means, hey, that's everything that a computer can do beyond what we've ever heard about working with documents.
Yeah, I like to present the point of view that the fundamental barrier we're confronted with is one of integration. It's the integration that is the basic challenge, that all the technology, email, HTML, all of the dynamic knowledge repository work is very good at the divergent phase of the divergent-convergent thinking model, but don't help an awful lot when it comes to the integration and pulling all this together. And as a result, as we evolve into the computer age with all of the internet stuff, the individual mind, which is our current unit of integration, is just being overwhelmed by all this data. And I would argue that the fundamental challenge we're confronted with is the ability to do this integration with larger entities, with NICs. And we need to be able to build NICs that are able to develop ideas that rival general relativity and then theory of quantum mechanics. And that's a social interaction problem as opposed to a technology problem.
That's why I go to the trouble of putting a human system up there. It's a basic, important part of the whole augmentation system. And all the customs, language, roles, models, everything else fits into there. And all of that has to evolve concurrently to make this work. So, I don't think you were pointing out anything other than that.
I was just looking for your concurrence or not.
Yes. It's extremely important. And how much people are willing to shift their customs or their practices or extend their vocabulary. How do you facilitate that evolution? And I come back to the scale. The scale of the challenge is enough that becomes hugely important that we learn how to facilitate that evolution. And think of technologies that might not even have a big market yet to get them out and available.
Yes, I'm very excited to hear all the ideas, and I think I've tried to implement some of it within my organization as Social Security Administration. And I come across the experience that it really is an integration issue. You have to have a commitment from a certain level of scope to be able to commit to that human machine interface to have that dynamic information revolution. And I also reflected, it's not only an ethical and an ideal issue, but also a very financial resource intensive issue. Relating back to my trip to Italy, where I go to Rome and I go to Florence, and I see all the wonderful artwork that was done and commissioned by the church where the resources were. I'm wondering, since you really created the mouse and have the patent on it, have been observing the evolution of that one, I'm wondering about the financial model that, you know, is needed to be evolving with all the ideas and capabilities and systems, the training on the system and of it, how long it might, how much it needs to evolve, but having you to discuss a little bit of your experiencing in observing the mouse and the evolution of it, from the time you conceived the idea to the prevalence, the way that the mouse is developed. I'm sure there was no economic model for making the mouse initially or even open it. I think it would be an interesting example now in the future of that, trying to relate to what needs to happen for this.
Well, I the way I grew up, a country boy, I had zero orientation about business building. All this idealism I have about what we ought to do in the world, I was along without much appreciation for that. But when I invented the mouse, it's 1963, and I thought it was a good idea, so I patented it. Incidentally, it was called the XY position indicator. and who started calling it a mouse? Well, that's one of my funny things. I never think about giving names to something like that. So I promoted a research grant, I think it was from NASA, to study the different screen selection devices to see which would be more effective. And then I happened to think, I thought of this thing once in the past, and I sketched it up with the engineer guy, Bill English, built it, and got into experiments, which were pretty good experiments, where subjects would have to access points, and the mouse just won everything. And so someplace in there, it began to be called a mouse. But we go back quite a while, once in a while, I'll say, hey, does anybody remember who first called it a mouse? But we didn't care much, and we thought finally we kept using it and solidly, but it was almost 20 years before world needed them, and we've been using it steadily in that. We assumed that it would probably escape and become something solid that would have an appropriate name. And there are almost a billion mice out in the world now, and every language you go to, it's your mouse. So anyway, I got 10,000 dollars. That's how I reward people when they get patents or something. And I think they sold the rights to Apple for all the mice they wanted to make for something like $80,000 or something like that. This wasn't appreciated for a long time by the people. And then the company Logitech, the big bonus I got from them is that they're the biggest mouse makers in the world. They've been giving me free office space for 15 years to pay for my secretary. Otherwise, I have.
Steve Jobs never take you to lunch?
Well, Steve Jobs, the first time he saw it, one of the only two or three times I ever talked to him, he's the guy that he. I came to work to him from Xerox, who had been working for me. He got booted out of the research world. In the commercial world, we were sort of near them, so he brought his boss over, and turned out to be Steve. And people at Farmhouse. One button is all you need. And that was the end of the discussion. Another big thing is that we were working on time-sharing computers. And which had huge advantages. And one of them being that we devised a really, really, very simple client that worked over the modems. It didn't have high speed connection. think we could get a trip to 9600 volt. And so our very simple thing, just pick up the mouse and the keyboard and the magic Kornic keyset and shift that off to the server, and it sent back what you shipped on the display. Very, very, very simple arrangement like that. But even 30 years ago, I could call somebody, any place in the country, we start supporting people. My conviction that you have to get evolution there, that, okay, as soon as we can, we're going to start supporting people over the ARPANET. And so we actually started a subscription business, and I actually hired five or so people to be peer support. So I took some of them in liberal arts graduates. So no computer guy is going to go out there and start. They just were doing great things out here because they had run into such strange paradigm things. Like at one place, boss made them put the two turtles they had off down the hall in the closet. And up there, well, he didn't want one there because he was so worried about making mistakes himself. And so this young woman that was helpful, I figured that out pretty soon. Told him, I'm just going to be in a hotel and not at home. I can be here early. And I can come here early and show you some before everybody gets here, and you get too busy, see? Oh, well, all right. So again, in a week or so, he was. But anyway, you know, find support like that, support people like that. But that was turned out to be one of the things that took us out. In 76, our artificial intelligence people were so sure that they're going to get so smart that they teach people how to. The office automation people were so sure that it had to be really, really easy because the secretaries use it. How about Tom's knowledge worker? And so it all had to be easy to learn. We were just getting shot down. That's the side of that stuff is too hard.
Anyway. I'm John Young from the ACU and Human Learning Project. I guess my overall concern is how we're going to organize our whole body of knowledge into some sort of coherent, usable whole, thinking about what's going on inside the DKR and how we're going to interact with it. I'm thinking now about topics like ontology is a semantic with an example of things like psych. How is the overall world community going to get access to the knowledge organized into usable form so that you go into this everything there is to know about a particular topic rather than having to just follow things to a multiplicity of discrete sources. And you can say, what is there you can say now about how things will go on inside the DKR?
Oh. That's a good question, Seth. And it's part of what needs to come evolve. And I got some feelings and thoughts about the kind of viewing and thinking and jumping. And pretty soon you get into point about what kind of new skills are people going to have to learn in order to learn from the DKR. And then what kind of best structure the characteristics of it. All of that. This argument structure gets set up. How can that be made? How much will people who don't have time to learn about how you look at an argument structure follow the rationale to just believe what's not to learn. And I think that the kind of computer tool set stuff that I'm offering in the Hyperscope and what we learned in Augment, etc., is part quite a ways beyond the GUI today, etc. So the best we can do is just find the best starting place we can think of.
have the best strategy for how we evolve from there. Did I miss a lot of that? I don't have any more than saying strategy. If that's the general path, I think we'd have to go. As we get going and we get people involved with us, a lot of refinements should become clearer and clearer if we, if by the right strategy we happen to get the right studies, etc., right issues dealt with.
Are you envisioning the generator here to be something the publisher decides or is it something that the user is actually controlling?
Oh, no. That view generator and the viewing options and how you specify them are all part of the environment, the interface, etc., that need to evolve. And one of the things I didn't mention, but going from here on into more and more complete systems in this pursuit of this open hybrid document system, the thing is, I say, look, if you have a really good comprehensive programming interface, an API, then you can plug whatever user interfaces you want in front of those. And that way, people that want something really simple, okay. Another associated thing that has to be pursued in here is how do you start measuring capability? And which kind of capability vectors are going to be important for what? Especially the important is the one of how do you gather all this and integrate it? It takes some AI tools, but also some really old people. So then you have very, very easy ones for people just to fudge around. And it says, well, that was like, what kind of vehicles can you drive? I can use my motor scooter. Well, are you qualified yet to use a four-wheel drive automobile? How about a truck? How about... And so there's one class of users I just call them high performance augmented support team. That are sort of like the, I put it, the people that take care of your accounting system. These are the logicians that can take care of really being sure of the logical structure of your unique they are solid. New stuff comes in. We arrange it.
Very briefly, I'm Robert David Steele from OSS.net, and Doug is one of my heroes. He was on 50 years behind him. I hope we'll have another 20 together.
Actually, 120?
No, actually, I hope I look as good as you when I'm 75. Very quickly, I think that Google is going to have a major impact on all of this. And despite Google's flaws in security and popularity, relevance rankings, and so on, I think Google plus Cisco application-oriented network is going to change the world. You add Cisco AON to Google Enterprise, a very robust outcome. I want to recommend to you a new book that is rocking the industry by Steve Arnold on Google. It is available from Infognotics.com in the UK. It is absolutely a revolutionary book on where Google is going and how it's going to impact on all of this. Imagine if Google and Amazon merge, apply Doug's ideas, and then buy Factiva, LexisNexis, and Dialog, all of which are collapsing with 1970s non-scalable database systems, and then open an intelligence marketplace where anybody can sell knowledge in an interactive, open way. Okay? If you look at the GAO report on the DoD gig, you know what's dead. If you look at the Arnold book on Google, you know what's alive. So, second, education. You cannot have a smart government in a dumb nation. If we don't get the Secretary of Education to change our educational system, I have a 16-year-old who gets A's in computers and D's in everything else because he won't sit still for a factory system that creates factory workers. We've got to get all this stuff down into the school system. Last but not least, semantic web and synthetic information. How many people are dealing with synthetic information and semantic web? That's not enough. Look it up. It's on my website. Anonymity. Doug
The big thing here is that the U.S. government is trying very hard to go toward anonymity. They don't want people to know what they're looking at, which completely breaks the cycle of expert interaction. So I think there's going to be a war in the next 5 years between those who desire anonymity and those who do not. And I believe that the people who are open will win. There are four opens. OHS is the fourth. Open source software, because state and local cannot afford anything else, and neither can NGOs. Open source information, open radio spectrum. The Koreans are much more efficient than we are. And OHS. And last but not least, economic model. The economic model that this introduces is called reality-based budgeting.
I'm glad I said that.
That's what you're opening up.
For the historical record, several times Samantha Webb has mentioned that as a grandfather of the proponent ideas, I was wondering what you would, what your opinion is on it, your observations, your thoughts.
Well, I'm afraid I don't know enough specifically, but the terminology and people I've heard being associated with it, I did great. I have to wait and see. Sorry.
And there may be some people here that can comment too, having heard your...
I remember I visited MIT and Tim Ersley a couple years ago, and somehow the way we were talking about things didn't quite seem to understand each other. Not that we were... Should have been home for dinner, so...
My name is Bill Smith, and I run an organization called ODII that deals with large-scale organization. And I also teach organizational science at GW. And Susan introduced me to Doug some, 10 or so years ago because she recognized that the base of our thinking was the same. Where Doug has its ABC, I have the reverse order, but I call it AIC. And it's an organizing process that has proved the scalability that Doug has talked about, where we've gone from, say, in Thailand, training 30 people in this organizing process, and it spread through the whole country on its own and was used by the government and so on. But I've always looked to see how can I connect Doug's work with this, and over 10 years I've not been able to do so, and I'm really asking for some help in even just understanding why this has not happened. I've been part of Susan's group, I've listened to everything that's been offered, and I now have an opportunity to do the same thing here in the United States. We started this process in southern Indiana, and before I began, I went to Susan and said, you know, the group, what can we do with the beginning group? Because, in a way, we start from the purpose that some group has. In this case, in Scottsdale, it's to improve the quality of life of the community, and then have that spread throughout Indiana. We already have people at the state level in Indiana doing this. So I said, what should we be doing at the beginning, you know, that can get you? And I know about collaborative tools, and so we've talked to people about collaborative tools, but it kind of doesn't take. And then I just have an insight now to say, well, what are we doing differently in Scottsdale that I've learned from all of those years of international development? And there's one unit that we use to move from stages and from one community to another, and it's a 20-minute video. And the function of this video recognizes that human beings should develop their capacity and to get things done are spiritual beings, they're emotional beings, and they're doing beings. And the video is able to capture all three of those. And then you know, when I look at Doug's work and so on, I say, yeah, that's the capability that we all want. But the next, which would be, seem to be the place to connect, they seem to be about the technology first. And now I've come away about the people first and the purpose first. And so now my dilemma, my request for help to you is, how can we get the purpose and the technology together right from the beginning of an organizing effort?
Well, thank you, Bill. I could use the terms co-evolution, and they have to be concurrent.
Yeah.
So we just haven't had the resources.
Yeah.
And my big thing is ongoing dialogue. I'm going to give a talk about the follows. And then I'm going to get a little bit of money. Well, the thing to do with the microscope is a nice place to start because it opens up all the pathways. Much more anyway. Well, there are different groups already formed. It could become NICs. Well, how to get that started? That's an evolutionary thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's how do you get the field of evolution going?
If I could add, because I'm standing halfway in between these two gentlemen, and I'd like to acknowledge how much I have learned and continue to learn from Doug and also from Bill, and from, for those of you that have been participating in our workshop series, which we try to depict as a place, kind of a frontier, open crossroads place for the different communities to come together and learn ideas and inspiration and the achievements of these two gentlemen have informed very much the workshop series. And then I also want to thank Peter again, because in this last year, the workshops have gone on for a couple of years, but this past year we added a bit of that authentication capability through the online, what we call the collaborative work environment, and you've heard the numbers and so on. And honestly, it is still at the very, very beginnings, but I appreciate, and I had appreciated, but I haven't seen what it can begin to do to have the communities form. And I guess in less than a year, we have now 10 communities of practice, you know, working to network monthly, and close to 700 individuals in one project that's highly leveraged, in that it is commissioned by OMB and the CIO Council. So it's, again, work in progress. We're learning, continue to learn, and we want to appreciate as well Brad Neiman, who brings to us the technical, the real-time readiness, the collaborative prototyping of some of the real-time tools. And of late, if you want to join us for our workshops, we're starting to do some hands-on exercises that begin to introduce people to some of the potentials of the semantic web, to start to address how do we get the right structure in a dynamic knowledge repository. So again, it's fledgling on all fronts, but it is part of that concurrent approach, and we'd like to have you join us, and we look forward to learning from all of you as well.
Thank you, Susan, for those kind remarks. And I'm glad I didn't make my comments and ask my questions before now, because those are preceded me, I think, laid the groundwork for it. I really admire and try to emulate what Doug has done for years now, thanks to Susan and his efforts. And I think we've accomplished two things, and we need to accomplish a third thing. The first thing I think we've accomplished is we've proved that the construct is sound, and it's working. We are building collective intelligence, and we are now at the point where I think we can call ourselves as having knowledge workshops that contribute to a dynamic knowledge repository. I think we've certainly learned it doesn't happen overnight. Even if we had it perfect at the beginning, it wouldn't have worked, because we're talking about a major cultural change here in the way people are used to working, particularly in the government. And we have learned along the way, and so I think we have to be persistent. That's the lesson we learned. We have to be persistent at this. We have to be grounded in the right principles. I think the second thing we're beginning to accomplish, we turned to Peter's wiki and the semantic web use of ontologies for quantifying these associations and relationships between things, like the one physicist's comment was, how do you quantify these things? But I think that leads us to the third thing that I think we need to accomplish, that I would call integrating the paradigms. And I thought it was interesting you and Tim Berners-Lee have talked, because clearly your work preceded the web and is still beyond what I understand to be the vision of the semantic web. And so it seems like we need a strategy for integrating these two major paradigms. In other words, is the dynamic knowledge repository and everything that you have beyond the semantic web, or is it something the semantic web should evolve to and include? So I think the discussion you have with him or his Lee is very important to have that discussion, further that discussion, and have more discussions in terms of the strategy for integrating the paradigms, because each community of interest has its paradigm, or we all individually have our paradigm. And he talks about this working globally and as well as working locally and the constant tension between the two. And so I think if we do that, if we work all across the spectrum from individual to global, with integrating these paradigms with some sort of strategy, we'll get there.
Thank you very much. I wanted to share three items that I think contribute to our collective IT, particularly the federal government. That is, I just got back from the Joint International Statistical Meetings in Minneapolis. What was very interesting, our theme this year is statistics in an uncertain world. And what came out of that was that we decided that we needed not to look just at our statistical and computing and mathematical power, but we have to get back to our social sciences and social statistics. And so what we're beginning to do now is talk about the need for an interdisciplinary approach to math and science that without the context and the subject matter, for example, if a physician needs a statistician, well, the statistician better have some subject matter of medicine or health. So to us, that's a big breakthrough that we're talking interdisciplinary. The second one has to do with a book that I've seen touted in the defense community. I don't know if anybody here is from the defense community, and it pertains specifically to the federal government role, and that is David Moss's book, When All Else Fails, the Government as the Ultimate Risk Manager. And again, that has to do with the paradigms that we think things are going a certain way because this is our knowledge. However, we don't know what's going on. And so when something happens that's outside of our current ken, how do we deal with that? So that if we look at risk and probabilities of risk, perhaps that would open up. But it gets back to the federal government again. You know, we can have the private sector, we can have academia, we can have really bright people. But when it comes down to the human, you know, the human race and the environment, it's governance. It's, you know, when all else fails, it's the government. And that is my third item, which is my work at the Census Bureau of Human Capital. And I kind of have to laugh because given the history of the census, well, we always have chaos every 10 years. You know, we know what's going to happen. You know, are things going to burn down? Are the computers not going to work? What are the politicians going to do? And what we've discovered now, and this is a real problem, and it's not just us, but all the federal sector, is the retirement of a large proportion of our intellectual capabilities. And so trying to keep the institutional memory, to keep our institution, which we find vital, to continue on and given the younger generation of how they think and process and synthesize and connect all over the world is a real challenge to us. So my question to you is, what would be your advice for the next leadership of the federal government as the baby boomers exit?
Okay. You went that long, and then all of a sudden you said it's the right Well, I'd like to have some ongoing dialogue. There's just one thing that I would like to have a way to interact and dialogue, and so I can understand more of the facets of there, and I can find out how much other people are sort of getting what I'm trying to say. Because I just feel very inadequate, you know, somehow pointing for years and I don't have getting it across at all. What's my problem? And can I do it? So one of the things I've been trying to get is some practical way to have more dialogue with people and see if we could coagulate a writer.
The Wise Elders Program at the
Substance
Bureau. Maybe we could dialogue for us there.
The Elders Program?
It's called the Wise Elders Program.
Oh.
But you need to have to get, but
you
don't
want to
the elders.
Oh, how old are you? Don't want to be. Get me your card.
Yes, my name is Tom Crispell. I work in the Shenandoah Valley and on regional cooperation among local governments for over 30 years, and also being a planner and involving myself in kind of the world of futures. One, something that I learned along the way is, you know, that innovation is not the problem, but it's the spread of innovation, which, and I think we've all had that experience, I think. It's good to hear that you've been at your work for 50 years, because some of us have only been at ours for 30 or 35, and it's encouraging. You know, it's that kind of individual initiative that's important. You know, and I'd agree with you completely that strategy is the level at which we need to be operating. But I think the question becomes, who is the author of the strategy? And it's really critical. And that's why, Jeremy Rifkin it was written in an article on government technology maybe a couple of years ago, said that, you know, all institutions are derivative, that the people are first. So religion, government, business, they all came about to serve the people. So, you know, we the people is probably the strongest paradigm. But in the dominant business model of this country, you always seek a proprietary advantage. So, again, we do need kind of collective investment through the government. And the strategy kind of what builds things is that, you know, the people are always in there. And so in your strategy, again, strategy is it, but can the person on the bus do strategy? Well, yes, they really ought to be doing strategy. And so the point of having an educated society, we've given up on educating people. And so you have a very small group. You know, there are many kinds of intelligence we've learned, and having children that have learning disabilities but are quite intelligent and they can function. You know, so we've designed some hierarchies that aren't serving all the people. And then there's a belief that certain people can't do things, so we have to dumb things down instead of smartening up people for a lifelong learning. So again, I think get we the people is the strongest paradigm. And so whatever. Let me stop.
That's a just terribly important considerations where they should go. I don't know how to progress with those kind of considerations in the most thoughtful, collectively smart way. All I can do. How long has any government system, what's the longest in the history of mankind that we know? What's the longest any governmental system before it fell apart?
Well, the thing is that, you know, businesses are not long-term. Governments have much longer survival and transitioning rates. And the democratic societies last longer. But, of course, they're experiments.
I just wanted to mention that there is at least one academic program that addresses the integration of what everyone's talking about.
Can't hear you.
And that is
American. Couldn't hear enough. Sorry.
Can't hear? Okay. I just wanted to say there's at least one academic program that I know of, because I'm a graduate of it, that addresses the integration, particularly with computer security and other fields, and that's the Master of Science at Iowa State University in Information Assurance. it's structured so the master's program is interdisciplinary, so your background can be political science, which is what mine was, or you can be computer engineering, you can be computer science, you can be mathematics, you can be the management information system. So we take core classes together so we understand computer security, but we also take a course on legal and ethical issues in computer security. So it was a really good program, and in fact, the NSF, through the National Science Foundation Scholarship Service, provides some funding for scholarship recipients and recipients.
Thank you.
So, Wyoming, I'm a domain operations analyst for Federally Funded Research and Development Center, and I also represent the DoD community in the transformation effort. So, I thought it was important to amplify some of the comments that I've heard here. One of my sayings is, it's a pleasure to be simple, and in an increasingly complex world, of course, we probably can all understand that. That's an old shaker, Kim, by the way. And, what really struck me, first of all, was when our speaker, our wonderful speaker, said, collectively developing, integrating, and applying knowledge. Well, the story is, wow, that's what we do in DoD. That's the roadmap for transformation, this whole complexity. So what I wanted to say to people here, like with Steve and his comment, is I think that each of us here can actually go back, what had resonance with us, what makes sense to our organizational culture, retake that back, and we can translate it with our people. And again, it's simple, but you start with the individual, and then you face the collective, and of course that's what brought down the wall in Berlin. So, that's all.
Hi, I'm Roger Maduro, and I've spent the last few years working on open source and large-scale enterprises, large-scale areas, and I've been focusing on the last few years on VISTA, which is the hospital information system that runs the Veterans Administration hospitals, over 160 hospitals and 150 clinics. And it's public domain, it's open source, and large number of hospitals in the private sector, state municipalities, and in fact, entire countries want to implement it. So I've been heavily engaged in that, and for the last few days, what I've been thinking through since I've had these discussions about disaster, VISTA for disaster preparedness, because it's a fully integrated system with logistics, and looking at what's going on in New Orleans, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, what kind of struck me is you've had a breakdown of every aspect of what you see as modern society, infrastructure, transportation, energy, communications, and my thought was, because I know a lot of the people in the room, was we have you here, you have a model here that addresses that kind of, in a way, a high level, that kind of situation. My first question would be, what do you see has to happen there to restore that part of the country? And the second thing, I think some of the people in this room individually are going to be having to address it, how do we help Orleans. Perhaps the idea would be maybe to set up a work group that could potentially integrate the ideas that you have on a high level to have addressing something that is very real in the neighborhood.
If you want to explore that kind of stuff, we're doing public service series of seminars, and there's a flyer over there talking about that next year, and it's going to explore some of these ideas about purpose-driven behavior. So pick up a flyer over there. It's a whole series. The next one's going to be on critical thinking, which Alex is going to be chairing.
Say that again.
There's a flyer over here on a series of seminars that deal with this kind of systemic purpose-driven behavior and integration issues. And there's a flyer over there. It's a series being put on by a couple of local professional societies to deal with this kind of thing.
I'm Owen Amber. I'm with the Department of Interior, and I co-chair the Government-wide XML Committee of Practice. On behalf of the CIO Council, I'm also managing the emerging technology lifecycle management process and website, which is at et.gov.
And the purpose of PC.gov is to enable literally anyone to identify an emerging technology component with the objective of trying to build community practice around that component. So if you have emerging technology components of interest to you that you would like to bring to the attention of the government community and try to build community practice around, you are certainly able to register them at et.gov, and the results will then speak for themselves. Isabella mentioned strategy, or I think Brand mentioned it first. The very first component identified at et.gov by me was strategy markup language. The fact that the government agencies are all required to have strategic plans, that those plans are in PDF format on their websites and can't readily be shared and analyzed, I think is a great opportunity. So, you know, my initial focus is on getting government agency strategic plans in valid actionable instance documents on their website so that various kinds of linking and analysis and so forth can take place. But literally anyone, if the strategy markup language is specified, could use the schema to specify goals and objectives of interest to them, which would theoretically enable all kinds of linkages based upon goal-seeking behavior.
It seems like a lot of you folks have been involved with this stuff for years, and I really appreciate Ms. Ingeborg's presence today and his contributions over the years. One of the things that I'm advising current clients on the South here is when you're talking about a community, and the term we, the people, was brought up, a community is essentially dynamic because you never know who's going to join, who's going to leave, who's going to lead, who's going to lead. So what we're doing in terms of this approach that we're working with for the continuity communications effort is we're looking at the person as the foundation of the community. And what we want to try and do is, and what we've done is establish a mechanism for each person and identify their interests. And the interests that they specify then are the basis for forming communities. And so instead of specifying up front what the communities are, the person's interests decide who, in fact, is also interested in the same subject, what their level of expertise, et cetera. And it's all done with a very simple object model, a very simple database, and it scales almost infinitely. So the idea of having communities is what comes from people working together or people communicating together. And people sharing things and exchanging things. So if you focus on the person and what the person's needs are, then the group of persons becomes the community. That's just the way we're implementing it, and it works out very well. It's a very clean process.
I'd like to be sure to get a link to that.
I wonder if there are any international organizations or efforts in other countries. Have you been asked to speak in other countries that, over time that you think that there's some interest there that you should know about?
Well, Norway a year ago, but just a few months ago there was a conference in Europe that they had me connect with. It's called Reboot. And one thing they wanted to do was take that 1968 presentation that was accidentally captured on film. Now it's a DVD. 90 minutes of that. And they watched the whole thing and then wanted to interact. And that was, it seemed to get a lot of excitement for an article I haven't followed up with. But that was certainly one thing they had to do. What if Nora is telling you something, Kate? Is that you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, she's a science, they call it attaché or something?
Yeah, Counselor for Science and Technology.
Okay,
so
Swiss.
Dora is Counselor for Science and Technology at the Swiss Institute.
I had some very nice discussion with Doug before that talk, and yeah, so just trying to figure out if we somehow could linking up to an international community or some governmental plan, but it wasn't discussed any further. So
why don't you describe your club?
In Washington, as their most more or less all embassies, they have Council of Science and Technologies, and they are organized in the Science and Diplomat Club. And so, yeah, we are sharing some knowledge and sending around invitations to events we're thinking we have common interests in, and it will also look forward to that community.
So, that would be an interesting thing. International, you know, communication based upon this kind of thing would be ideal. So we just voted you to do that.
And Doug, I was just thinking I meant to ask if there's anyone who is joining us remotely still on the line that has a question for Doug.
Doug, would you like to say anything about the Wikipedia as an emergence of any of your ideas?
I'll repeat that question. Would you like to say anything about the emergence of the Wikipedia with regard to your ideas?
Well, I think it's a marvelous example, and I'd say it's a very good first stage towards kind of the approach of getting an evolving knowledge-based dynamic. What about mutual addressability, et cetera, between them, and some of the conventions about structure logic and all that, but it's a great start. And that's what I say.
It's really hard to think about wrapping this up. Let me say, on one level, I'm looking forward to many more continued conversations, and specifically with regard to the people who are wondering about the semantic web ideas that are showing great potential relative to the trajectory that Doug has described, and I'm hopeful that within our community that's participating in the workshops that there'll be some continued dialogue with you, Doug, on that, because from what I know kind of in between these two worlds, I really see some good connection.
I'm sorry, somebody wanted to...
And I guess then what I would like to say is this morning to me has been very satisfying and very gratifying. I continue to learn so much from Doug, and then the draw from the wealth of talent and resources that individuals who are willing to share who've been here this morning. I would hope that you would consider joining us at future workshops. What we try to seek to do, if you remember from Doug's slide at the Frontier Outpost, we try to create an open forum for the type of dialogue that can allow us to not cross past each other because our words aren't well understood, but to really spend some time together. It's a little unfamiliar because it goes beyond your sort of familiar place of expertise, but kind of our motto is that it's the space where, the space where we really welcome the multiple forms of expertise, and it is kind of the notion that as the problems grow complex, there isn't any one individual or small group that can manage. So you can continue to be an expert in your setting, but why not, you know, once a week, once a month, as part of the real work, we begin to institutionalize people leaving the desk, going to an unfamiliar place with a real scenario, practice, rehearse together what it is that they might need to be frontier space to the frontier outpost. I learned that the shoreline is the frontier space from Malta, but where the finite meets the infinite. And so have your sandbox where you're really well regarded, but have that shoreline where you can kind of walk together. And scanning that horizon is when you want to have others with you, and others that bring different areas of strength and expertise. And that was the success of the Lewis and Clark. And I think that's part of that pace, accelerated pace that we're faced with that really demands that. So we're, again, on a very small level, seeking to do that, and we do that under the auspices of the GSA office that is really seeking to break down the barriers across the levels of government in order to improve citizen services. We're doing it from the CIO council level, where we're pulling together on all of the data and information sharing issues. We have a team led by a gentleman in Mike Contact Homeland Security, a team of over 100 people. So most of our workshops of late have been focusing on these approaches, including governance. And then the third group is Simone has left, but Simone's organization represents how our science agencies pull together and coordinate the research agenda. And so the ideas that are raised here actually feed the research cycle. And then what we hope, and what's now beginning to happen, is that the research community is finding our forum to be a place for the good university research findings to be shared. So again, if we can kind of accelerate the uptake of the good findings. And with that, I'll just mention our next workshop on September 23. One of our presenters is from the University of Michigan Business School, and she'll be sharing her decades-long research on the factors attributable to the success of virtual teams, co-located teams. Universities increasingly, it's a big part of how they're doing research. Difficult, but that's where the breakthroughs come in as well.